Hello and welcome to another episode of Unauthorized Disclosure. I am one of your hosts, Rania Kalik, and I am joined by the show's other host, Kevin Gastola. Hey, Kevin.
Hello, Rania.
So today we have a great guest on. We have Mark Weisbrot. He is an economist and co-director at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Thanks so much for joining us, Mark.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
So the reason we're having you on is because last week you released a report co-authored by, it was you and Jeffrey Sachs, about sanctions on Venezuela and the impact of those sanctions. And you made some startling findings. I think the most horrifying of which was that an estimated 40,000 people have died in Venezuela from 2017 to 2018 as a result of the sanctions that Trump enacted starting in 2017. There were other shocking findings in this. It didn't receive the attention it deserved. So we want to talk to you. We want to hear about some of the more specifics in the report. So I guess, can you give our listeners just kind of a broad overview of this report and what it means?
Yes. Well, it really shouldn't be surprising that sanctions kill people. They really are kind of a form of warfare, like a medieval siege of a city where you starve people. And they really do target the civilian population. You know, there are estimates of the sanctions in Iraq from 1991 to 98, and some are between 400 and 500,000 children died as a result of the sanctions. So this estimate of how many people died from sanctions in Venezuela is based on an increase in the mortality rate, which is done by survey data, and it was done by groups that were opposed to the government, of course. And but it's from 2017 to 2018. And so the mechanism by which this happens is also kind of obvious. So, for example, the UN estimated that there were in last year 80,000 people with HIV who hadn't had retroviral treatment since 2017. And there were 16,000 people who needed dialysis, and 16,000 people with cancer, and 4 million people with diabetes and hypertension. And many of them can't get the medicine they need, the insulin or cardiovascular medicine. So if you cut off imports to the country, which is what the sanctions do, they cut off a large amount of imports, because the only way that Venezuela pays for imports is by selling oil. And of course, they could also do other things like sell assets, but the sanctions also froze billions of dollars of their assets. They couldn't sell it. They even took over $1 billion worth of gold that Venezuela had at the Bank of England. And they said that they couldn't have that. They just basically stole it. So if you cut off all the sources of foreign exchange for the country, then you're going to cut off imports, and you're going to cut off essential medicines and medical equipment and the inputs that you need to maintain infrastructure for water and sanitation and health. And a lot of people are going to die. And you don't know exactly how many. I mean, the 40,000, I said, you know, again, was an estimate based on increased mortality. But it could have been a lot more than that. It could have been somewhat less, but it was tens of thousands of people. We can be pretty sure of that.
Why is it, Mark, that these sanctions under Trump have been more destructive than the sanctions under Obama? What was the difference?
Well, the first sanctions were put in by Obama, first formal sanctions, in March of 2015. And ironically, Obama did that as a sop to the right wing, you know, people like Rubio, the Florida lobby, because he wanted to open relations with Cuba. And but those sanctions were on individuals. And, you know, we didn't really go into that in the paper because we didn't have room and didn't want to complicate it too much. But I mean, we mentioned it, but we didn't go into the damage that those two, those were on individuals. But those actually caused a lot of damage, too, because it just isn't quite as direct as the ones that I described, which began in August of 2017. And the way the individual sanctions do damage is, for example, when you sanction government officials like the finance minister, they can't do a lot of commercial activity that they need to do around the world, and they get cut off from banks accounts because banks are very much afraid of being sanctioned. That's how the U.S. enforces these sanctions, is by sanctioning the actual financial institutions that go against them. And so they become very cautious about all kinds of transactions, including the transactions for food or medicine or other types of credit. So those sanctions really do hurt. And they also hurt in another way, because when Obama made the executive order, and Trump too, by U.S. law, they're required to declare two things. One is that Venezuela is creating a national emergency for the United States. And if that sounds familiar, that's because it's the same law that Trump had to use in order to take funds without congressional approval to build that wall with Mexico. So they actually declared that Venezuela's national emergency, and the president has to declare that Venezuela presents an unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security of the United States, which of course, both of those are ridiculous statements. And that's why I argue that in the paper that these sanctions are really illegal under U.S. law as well as international law, because anybody can see that. I mean, they don't even bother to make some kind of a case that either of those statements is true. But the idea that Venezuela is an extraordinary and unusual threat to the national security of the United States, when the president puts that out there, everybody knows what happens to countries that are a national, an extraordinary security threat to the U.S. What happened? Nicaragua, they got destroyed with an embargo and a war, Iraq. Again, same thing happened to them. So countries that are put on that list or designated in that way, they're going to run into terrible trouble. So the country loses a lot of investment in commerce.
And so it wasn't long before the events of the past week on particularly April 30th, where we saw Juan Guaido make another push, that we heard from Elliot Abrams, and he's the special envoy representing the Trump administration going to Venezuela, working with the opposition. And he talked about how basically, this is what we're seeing in Venezuela. He made the claim publicly that, it's about pushing for ending preventable and debilitating diseases. It's about no more blackouts and having clean water. I just wanted you to speak to this essential point, which is that the damage done from the sanctions is inflicted intentionally to then make it Maduro's responsibility and help the opposition, because I don't think a lot of people really bother to disentangle. It's almost always universally presumed that what we're seeing as far as the crisis is Maduro.
Yes, well, the economic crisis did precede the sanctions, but the thing is, the sanctions made it enormously worse, and they also prevent the government from getting out of the recession and hyperinflation. Recessions or depressions or hyperinflations don't last forever. In fact, as we noted in the paper, hyperinflation in Latin America, there's been like seven of them since World War II, and the median duration is about 4 months. So the hyperinflation actually isn't that hard to get rid of in normal circumstances. But what the sanctions do is prevent the government from taking any measures to get rid of the hyperinflation or for the economy to recover. And so that's another way in which they kill people. And so that's why I say the mortality, the number of people killed by the sanctions could actually be much higher than 40,000, because 40,000 is just assuming that the increase in mortality that you saw from 2017 to 18 was a result of the sanctions, but the mortality could have gone down instead of up, because, and you would have expected it to, because the in the absence of sanctions, that is, it could go down and will go down at some point, because the recession and the hyperinflation would recede. And, you know, the point you raised about what the sanctions are doing and the intentions, we included a quote from Pompeo at a press conference, which showed that the sanction, the destruction and death from the sanctions is not really collateral damage. That is, it's not like even a bomb where, and sometimes, of course, the U.S. bombs civilians deliberately, but when they don't and when they kill them as collateral damage, it's a side effect. But here, if you listen to Pompeo, you can see that it's actually an intention to inflict this harm on people and to kill people. Let me quote it here. This is from a press briefing he did on March 11th. And Matt Lee, who's one of the better reporters, he's from Associated Press, who asks hard questions at these things. He said to Pompeo, "Are you satisfied with the pace of the momentum behind Guaido and his leadership?" And that was based on, you know, the fact that 3 months had gone by since the initial proclamation of Guaido as the interim president. And they had had several attempts where they thought they were going to overthrow the government, like they did in the last few days. And nothing was working. And Pompeo said, "Well, we wish things can go faster, but I'm very confident that the tide is moving in the direction of the Venezuelan people and continue to do so. It doesn't take much for you to see what's really going on there. The circle is tightening. The humanitarian crisis is increasing by the hour. You can see the increasing pain and suffering that the Venezuelan people are suffering from." So he's actually telling them that this is what's going to bring about the change.
And then another thing about your report that you probably can't document too is what the impact is and how it's influencing the internally displaced persons or the refugees from Venezuela.
Well, I mean, we do say there's an estimate that we cited, most of this data is from the UN, that another 1.9 million people are expected to leave the country this year. And, you know, and so that is largely attributable to the continued depression and hyperinflation, which, again, the sanctions make it impossible or nearly impossible for the economy to emerge from.
You know, what's really striking is, I mean, these are unilaterally coming from the U.S., but then the U.S. is basically bullying other countries into complying by threatening to sanction or fine their various international institutions or any companies that do business with Venezuela. And is that like a common tactic? I mean, is that legal? And is there anything, it doesn't seem like there's anything anybody can do to get past this. Like India, you mentioned in the report, India tried to buy some of the oil that the U.S. was refusing to buy from Venezuela. And then the U.S. threatened India with sanctions.
Yeah, it's really outrageous. And it is all illegal. And we mentioned also Gazprom, the Russian financial institution. Now, here's a country that is obviously not supporting the sanctions in any way. And there, this large financial institution in Russia cut off the account of the state oil company, PDVSA, which is one of the main accounts, of two main accounts that the government uses to buy things like food and medicine. And they cut it off because the U.S. threatened to sanction Gazprom, which would mean they would be cut off from all kinds of commerce in the world. So that is how they enforce them. And it's a bigger problem. And I think we're going to do a longer paper on the sanctions in general as a weapon, because it is, yes, it's illegal, as I mentioned, under U.S. law, but also under international law. And the OAS Charter, for example, so treaties that the U.S. has signed, the OAS Charter prohibits this kind of coercion or, you know, interference in the internal affairs of a of another government, right? Because, and you have this principle of self-determination in other laws and treaties, and also, you know, you have a whole body of international human rights law, which this violates. And these sanctions are unilateral. They're not sanctions that are approved by the United Nations, which the United Nations is allowed, the Security Council, under the UN Charter, can, in fact, implement sanctions. And I personally think that that's wrong, too, but that would be legal under international law.
Right, like the sanctions on Iraq in the 90s were actually UN sanctions.
That's right. Those were approved by the UN.
But I mean,
I don't
it's
know
just,
if
it's
they
like,
all were, though, because sometimes the UN approves sanctions and then the US adds on their own, too.
It just seems like a very like a globally dictatorial behavior for one country to just be able to bully the entire world into placing a whole country under blockade, under economic blockade.
Yeah, it really is. And it has become, I think, the main weapon of war for the United States. So it's more powerful in terms of its use and impact than the U.S. military, the CIA, the drone strikes, which are often CIA. For all these other things, I think they're less of an instrument of U.S. Domination and imposing the will of Washington on the rest of the world than sanctions are. And that's, you know, the message that they're sending. And governments get this message, too, that, you know, you can't really get on the wrong side of the U.S. or you're going to end up like that. And, you know, Iran has sanctions right now, too. And the IMF actually stated publicly that they, you know, they lowered their projection for the GDP growth in Iran from -3% to -6% this year. And they said publicly that it was a result of the sanctions. And so it is a terrible thing, I think. No country should have that power to inflict this kind of damage and cause this kind of death and suffering. And, you know, they have this because of the U.S. domination of the international financial system. Over 60% of the reserves of central banks is held in dollars, and most commerce also takes place in dollars.
I want to ask you one more question, and then I'll throw it over to Kevin. I'm wondering how you respond to a common talking point by those who support the opposition, but also one that is prevalent in the media, which is that the sanctions of Venezuela are targeted towards individuals only, and that's not what's killing people. But people constantly say it's just targeted towards individuals. So I guess based on this report, how do you respond to that?
Well, you know, I tell them to get an internet connection. It's all the executive orders are posted on the web when they're issued. And you can see the August 2017 one. and the financial embargo that it imposed on the country. And that's not an individual. I didn't even mention, but the January sanctions were far worse. And there the media does recognize, although it's buried and you have to look for it. And that's why you do have still people. I mean, I've been on radio shows where people say exactly that to me. Well, they're just targeting individuals. I mean, what are you talking about? You know, the sanctions imposed in January basically imposed a trade embargo. And you can see the oil production dropped by 36% from January to March. 2 months, they lost 36% of their oil production. That means 36% of the revenue that goes to importing food and medicine and medical equipment and everything else. And that's not a matter of dispute. There's nobody who says that didn't happen. And although there are people who do say there are a couple of economists challenge their paper and they say that that big drop, it didn't happen because of the sanctions, which I think is ridiculous. And that just came out yesterday. I'm going to respond to that. But I think the other thing that people don't know, and I've been on the Hill and I've noticed that, even members of Congress who publicly supported the recognition of Guaido as the so-called interim president of Venezuela, they don't even realize what that does. That imposes a broader and financial and embargo, and also a trade embargo by itself, because it says that any oil that the government sells, which again is their source of dollars for both the public and private sector, so it's not even just the government. Any oil that the government sells, is the revenue has to go to Guaido. It can't. So that's a trade embargo right there. And it even makes it very difficult for to import medicines with the cash that they have, because they've cut off these banks and financial intermediaries. They're called I'm getting the name of the technical name for the banks that all financial institutions and governments, correspondent banks, that's what they're called, the correspondent banks that the government or the private institutions in Venezuela use around the world to engage in international financial transactions. Those are cut off too. So you had, for example, a shipment of medicine that the UN wanted to send to Venezuela, and the government couldn't pay for it because they had no means of actually transferring the money. So that's what they're doing. It's quite devastating.
And I had one more quick question before we wrap with you, which is, you do address the issue of this electricity crisis that we witnessed. It made a lot of headlines back in March. You assess, to what degree these issues with energy are being fueled by sanctions. Can you just address that point quickly?
Well, the backup for this hydroelectric power generator that failed, the backup for that is electricity that relies on diesel fuel, for example, and other inputs. And so that didn't work in large part because of not being able to get these inputs as a result of the sanctions. And just one more thing, if you have a minute, I think is important for people to say, is that there is opposition to this in Congress. The Congressional Progressive Caucus, which has 100 members, put out a statement against the coup, and not just against military intervention, but it also said that they're against the Trump's attempt at regime change. But also, there were 16 members of Congress signed a letter against the sanctions. And this is going to continue to grow. And I think it's very important for people to realize this because, you know, as you both know, both houses of Congress voted to cut off U.S. military involvement in Yemen. And that was against the lobbies of Israel and the Saudi lobby and the whole so-called national security state, the Pentagon, the big arms contractors. All of them weighed in against these two bills, and they still passed. And so, and this was because of grassroots organization, and you know, thousands, tens of thousands of people pressuring their members of Congress. So I think that's the best shot at ending this right now. And I want to just tell anybody who has a member of Congress that we don't have one with a vote in Washington, D.C., but the rest of the country does. And so I think that's very important.
Well, we want to send you off here, but I just want to echo what you're saying because it's really important. And I would even take it a step further and say, if you're seeing members of Congress speak out and talk about what we've said here today on these very important issues, that you should defend them from attacks because we know they'll be smeared as dictator apologists and all manner of different slurs. But they're really doing what they should be doing as representatives in Congress.
Yeah, and go ahead, Mark. Sorry. Well, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I'm saying that's a good point.
I was going to say people like Ilhan Omar.
Yeah, of course.
On that note, Mark, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this really, really, really important issue. Thank you for the report that you did. It's pretty important to have that out there just because there hasn't been any sort of look into the impact of the sanctions like this. So thank you so much for all the work you're doing. And we look forward to hopefully having you back on at some point in the future to talk about better news.
Sure. Thank you very much.
We have one quick update for you before we conclude. Rania is in DC at the moment, or visiting her home in Virginia. And she's been able to get down to the Venezuelan embassy. If you've been following her on Twitter, you may have seen her latest reports or updates from the Venezuelan embassy in D.C. It is besieged. It has been surrounded by opposition activists, people who fervently believe in what Juan Guaido and the United States are doing to the Venezuela people. And there have been aggressive activists there. They've been taunting these anti-war organizers. Some of these people are from Code Pink. Some of the people are from, I think, the Party for Socialism and Liberation, other smaller collectives that do left-wing organizing in DC have been supporting. The police there have allowed these opposition activists to surround and prevent supplies from coming into the building, to block and trap people. They have done very little to protect the safety of whether it be sympathetic journalists or the organizers inside. They're basically allowing the isolation of this building, which the policy right now is that the US government would like to seize control of this embassy. It has its own diplomats that they would like to be able to put inside the building and let take it over. Even though it belongs to Venezuela, it should still be in the hands of Maduro. One of the updates equated Code Pink and these embassy protectors to assassins, suggesting that they had invaded the Venezuelan embassy, that they support the killing, the starvation of the Venezuelan people. The scene is really escalating. They're escalating, they're ramping up tensions, they're inciting. And it's the sort of climate that can really breed violent activity. The video that has been captured by Rania and Anya Perampil has shown that there are racists outside that are throwing slurs and engaging in homophobia. And Also on May 4th in the evening, Rania shared video of a tactic that they're now using when the sun goes down and they shine the strobe lights at the embassy so that it's almost impossible for anyone inside to sleep during the night. They blast horns at the building. If there are any noise ordinances or any sort of disturbing the peace kinds of codes that are supposed to be followed by community, particularly Black residents of the DC area, they're not being enforced by the police. Over on Embassy Row here, the police, the Metro police, are allowing for this sort of disruptive activity to go on. And obviously, this would not be allowed in a residential neighborhood. So we'll continue to follow what's going on here, but we wanted to acknowledge the ramping up of tensions as it relates to our conversation that we had with Mark Wise Brought, and we really thank him for joining us on this show. We have an announcement for our patrons. We will be doing a show with Abby Martin and Robbie Martin of Media Roots. And this is going to be our reward for patrons. We expect to be posting content that will be available exclusively to individuals who are supporters. It's our way of saying thank you to all of you who have provided tremendous support for Unauthorized Disclosure over the last couple of years, especially since we were able to get up our show on Patreon and begin to develop the show and grow it. You've been an incredible base of support, and we're going to start with this show, but it by no means will be the last time that we reward our patrons for the kinds of support that they have been willing to show us. We expect to talk about media issues, to hear from Abby and Robbie about the way in which some of these stories are covered and how they use their show to counteract the narratives that are out there. There's a lot of similarities between our two shows, but we also know that there are shared audiences with people who support both of the shows being very generous in supporting both of our works. So we look forward to being able to share that next week. And once again, thank you for all of your support.